Rio de Janeiro, nigga. Cape Town, South Africa.
I never make songs to disrespect women or to judge people about
the way
they live.
Okay, so I'm here. Finally, we have Susan Strait, who is most recently the author of Take One Candle, Light a Room. Susan, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I love being in New York in the fall. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and you picked a very nice period. It's really kind of a little warmer than the usual. I heard in Portland it was actually snowing.
Yeah, and it was. Yeah. We had horrific and torrential rains in Southern California while I was gone.
Yeah.
And yesterday, my daughter and I walked 22 blocks through Central Park, took our jackets off. We were sweating a little bit.
Yeah.
The ginkgo trees, is that the ones that are in vivid bloom?
I believe so.
It's astonishing.
I'm not a tree expert.
They look like coral. It was very nice.
Well, let's go ahead and get to the book. I know that one of the chief inspirations with this book, as with all of your books, is simply observing the people who are around you, that is often the starting point. I'm curious, however, at what point did this book serve as a response to Katrina? Because the sense I got when reading this was that the first part, Katrina is very much outside the scope of these characters, and then it just enters with a big bang in the second and the third parts. I'm also wondering if the first part of Candle was written with Katrina in mind, or was it sort of written parallel with the last novel, A Million Nightingales, because there is, of course, the family line is explored here yet again.
That's exactly, it's actually the geographic, not coincidence, but the geographic confluence of these particular events. When I started the two book series, I actually started Take One Candle, Light a Room first.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out what was going on between Fantine and her mother.
Yeah.
Her mother was so angry. Fantine's a successful travel writer who lives in L.A. and travels the world, and her mother is absolutely, there's a line in there where it's bordering on hate, because she won't come home, and she doesn't live at home, and she's not in her mother's view every day. And I couldn't figure out what's going on with this mother, why does she feel this way, because that's exactly how my mom is. And it's because I realized there are only two kinds of people in the world. There's people who stay and people who leave. And I actually stayed. But I leave enough that my mom gets angry. With Fantine, it's her mother's fear and anger are completely based in the roots of slavery.
Yeah.
When you had a beautiful daughter like that, you had to keep your eye on her at every moment, and she should never leave your sight. And even genetically, that's been passed down to her mother, the time when your daughter could be sold away from you during slavery. So I had to go back then. I wrote the beginning of Take One Candle, went back and spent 4 years writing A Million Nightingales.
Uh-huh.
And that was to discover the roots of a family like Fantine's, where you had a beautiful mixed-race woman, Moinette, who, think about the original Anchor Babies. If people are going to make fun of true Americans and Anchor Babies, okay, Senegalese slave women and French and English sugar brokers and sugar planters, here are their children. Those are the original Americans in that part of the world. Think about it. You had Native Americans and you had mixed race people who were born on the soil. So once I was sort of, I went to Louisiana four times and was working on A Million Nightingales, it had to be set in Plaquemine Parish. That was the parish that worked for me, and then Moinette is sold away from her mother. And it was just heartbreaking for me to write that part.
Yeah.
That was actually the scariest part of the book, that part. And so Plaquemine Parish turns out to be the epicenter, in a sense. It was actually where Hurricane Katrina made landfall. It devastated New Orleans, as you know, in a man-made way. So A Million Nightingales takes place in this exact physical landscape. When I went back and started Take One Candle, Light a Room, Glorette, the best friend, had been killed in 2000. This book started in the fifth anniversary. All of a sudden, I thought, Hurricane Katrina's going to hit in a week. My gosh.
Yeah.
They're going to go to Louisiana. It happened.
Accidental mathematics.
Absolutely happened that way. It was really no fortuitous, like, design on my part. The story dictated it. And when Victor got shot, I knew they were going to flee to Louisiana, because there are so many young guys around me in my neighborhood that when something bad happens, they'll go to their auntie's house in Oklahoma, or they'll go to Louisiana. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
And that just, it came about that way.
So we could blame you for the Category 5 hurricane.
Oh, you know, my youngest daughter, her birthday is the 30th of August. And she had a bunch of people over for her 9th birthday party. And we spent the whole day watching African-American people pleading for someone to save them on rooftops, watching drowned bodies. It was a scarring experience from my youngest child, who's the darkest skinned of my kids, and started crying and made me turn it off, because she felt as if people who looked like her were lying on roofs, dying and drowning, and no one cared. I can't even explain to you how much it hurt us to watch that. And so then when I began working on the novel, it brought back to me how much all of America watched it and had different reactions. And my daughter's reaction was, if I were there, no one would care about me.
Yeah.
And no one would save me. That was bad. It was bad.
But it is interesting also that the novel ends with the words, "We are still here." It's interesting also that you get to Katrina. I don't think it gives away the book to point this out, but you don't really get into the aftermath of what has happened. The sense I got when reading this, and not just because you have the candle theme of the title, and not just because you have, of course, Fantine is about to turn 40, going over the hill in some capacity, and not just because you have a book that is rooted in Rio Seco and then transforms almost into a road novel, reminiscent also to my mind of Lolita.
Mine was the road trip from hell.
Yes, exactly. But the sense I had was that there was some tremendous turning point you wanted to capture thematically in terms of American race relations. And it wasn't just a matter, I think, of the math lining up. I mean, clearly you were going backwards in the past. Did shifting back in the past allow you to kind of concentrate upon what's been happening in the present? Have we turned a corner? Have we gone over the hill? Or what can fiction do to capture that? Is it really a matter of just getting a theme like that in mind when you're working on a novel like this? Or is it a matter of just letting every form of exploratory idea or exploratory vernacular stick to your massive narrative?
See, no one else has asked me about that last line in my travels. And that for me, when I'm writing a novel, I always know the end. When I'm about two-thirds of the way through, I write those last 10 pages. Yeah. And then I have the most interesting part is figuring out the last third of the novel, how I'm going to get to that end. And I always knew that what was going to happen at the end. But you're completely right. I feel as if I've been given a gift because I've lived in the same place my whole life. And I've been writing about these characters for 20 years. This is 20 years. My first book came out in 1990. That with what I'm trying to say about race and history and slavery, it's very interesting to talk to my three girls. The two oldest are African American studies majors and then double major with art history and history. So we talk about the fact that America seems to want to say, well, slavery, that was a long time ago. Shouldn't those people have gotten over it? When in our own family, there are people who were scarred by things that happened five generations ago because a man didn't get over something and then married a woman who was attacked who married a man. And that is a legend that is passed down in the same way that people pass down legends of the Holocaust or World War I. In England, everything was transformed by World War I. Entire generations of women didn't get married because so many men were killed in World War I. How can America not, you know, acknowledge these are things that still resonate in life? So you're exactly right. I feel lucky that what I focus on is the characters. And here was Fantine. And she loves to go to Europe and look at this painting, the Bourbaki painting, during which she's looking at North African soldiers who are being made fun of because of their race by, you know, the very people that they're supposed to be helping. Yeah. And so race has always been that way. And then when they get to Louisiana, you're absolutely right. Here is a people who have been in the same place since they were brought here forcibly and landed in Plaquemine Parish. And they made their living with oysters and shrimp and fish. Don't even get me started on then the BP oil spill happens, right? Yeah. But this is six and seven generations of people. Why would they have to leave when this is the home that they were brought to? And over again, you've got a hurricane or you've got a flood, and yet they still tenaciously cling. Why wouldn't we honor that instead of saying, well, why don't those people just leave? Yeah. I mean, if you grew up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, which one of my editors, who's a great, great editor, she was born in the same neighborhood that her mom was born in, Upper East Side of Manhattan. Like, that's her neighborhood. I think what I'm trying to say about America is that it's a series of villages. And everyone has a village. Again, people stay or people leave. But the idea that Americans want to forget that you come from a village, whether it's the Upper East Side or Plaquemine Parish, that's your village and you have to honor it. And Fantine is the ultimate rootless traveler who goes on the road trip from hell with her father. Her father was really, again, a pivotal character to me. I thought about Gustav and Enrique for months before I wrote this, and I wrote two short stories about them. The way that they became brothers was based on a true story told to me by an elderly neighbor. he came to my house for me to write letters for him because he couldn't read or write. And I wrote letters to the VA. He was missing a little finger from the Korean War, and he was still trying to get money for it.
Yeah.
And I grew up with his son, so he would come to my house, and I would write letters for him. And one day we were sitting on the porch, and he told me the story of how he was an orphan. I mean, his dad was killed when his mom was pregnant with him. And he was 7 years old, and he was hungry, and he wanted some meat. And no one would give him any meat. No one would go get any meat. So he took a hammer, he walked 3 miles, found a pig on a farm, killed it, dragged it 3 miles back to his house, 7 years old, and said, cook me some meat. So that, to me, the Enrique Gustav, those are the men that I grew up listening to their stories of immense deprivation, of walking 50 miles to go find a job, of not ever having a mother and father and making themselves into brothers. So that meant a lot to me, too, is that family at the end of the Plaquemine Parish Delta would say, we're still here. It doesn't matter what you do to us, we will still be here.
Yeah.
Enrique was a big part of that for me.
Sort of related to this desperate hunting, I have to ask you, where did you get the idea of wrapping bacon around a gunshot wound as a home remedy? I asked a forensic science master's, I asked a medical student, and they had not heard of this, and I had not heard of this. Aha! You did.
My mother-in-law told me that.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law, I miss her so much. She died the year that youngest child was born. And the last thing that we whispered in her ear was that I was pregnant with her third granddaughter of our family. I mean, she had 25 grandchildren. My mother-in-law could have been born in Mississippi. She could have been born in Arkansas. She could have been born in Calexico. No one ever knew where she was born. We had to get her a birth certificate when she was 50. My mother-in-law told me that when they were so poor, probably in Mississippi, that you would wrap bacon around the wound or salt meat, more likely salt meat, and that the salt pulled out the infection. She told me that when my children were really, really young. I mean, I knew her from the time I was 16 on. And Rosette had this horrible infection on her leg, and we couldn't figure out what it was. And we had tried everything, antibiotics, everything. And one night it was as if my mother-in-law spoke to me, and I had a piece of maple-cured bacon, Farmer John's stupid maple-cured bacon, and I took the fat part, and I put it on Rosette's wound, and I wrapped a dish towel around it. And the only thing I had to tie it with was Christmas tulle, like wrapping ribbon.
Wow.
She kept it on all night, and in the morning, pulled it off, and the infection came out with the piece of bacon. It was the most disgusting thing you can imagine.
That's amazing.
And her wound healed over. And I just thought, okay, this is Alberta, you know, telling me what to do from the beyond. And that's exactly where that came from.
I'm shocked that if this has happened, why no mystery novelist picked this up or anything like that. That sounds like the coolest way to get rid of
I took her to the dermatologist who's Chinese.
Yeah.
And she was like, no, that's not true. That's not true at all. It couldn't have happened. And she dug a big hole in Rosette's leg after that, and Rosette has a horrible scar now.
Oh, wow.
So for us, the bacon, we should have just stuck with Grandma Alberta.
Yeah.
So
you must bring home the bacon.
Well, the sad thing is that is kind of one of those folk remedies that was passed down to me from my mother-in-law, along with the title of the book.
Yeah.
Take One Candle, Light a Room is something I heard some older woman say at some family reunion, and someone said, oh, is that your only child? And she was like, take one candle, light a room. And I was like, wow, that's the best phrase I could ever imagine. In a kind of defiant way to say, yes, I have one child, and that's all I've ever needed to make my life. So everything I've been given like that is kind of like a gift from listening, I think. I'm the person who listens. You know?
Yes. I wanted to touch upon what you were mentioning earlier about people being scarred, because I noticed quite a good deal of scarring in this book. I'll even bring up some examples. I mean, what you do descriptively with the body is really interesting. For example, with Bettina, her fat had collected below her shoulders, pushing out like a shelf under her bra. The menacing Mr. McQuine, so fat his stomach folded like a mushroom. You have the teeth like castanets or white chiclets. So you have that body imagery, but then you have something more interesting where you have Fantine getting revenge on the guy who tries to rape her, a tiny dent that filled with blood. Fantine's father, a series of scars on his left cheekbone like complicated Chinese symbols. A security guard, cheeks scarred as if acid had been thrown at him. This is all extremely interesting stuff. The idea that the body can either push out as a kind of fat that is almost waiting to be punctured in some sense. And I'm curious how this came about, specifically to this novel.
I think the funny thing is having scars be like the roadmap of your life on your body. The other kid sitting over there, the 19-year-old, one time she counted her scars, and I wrote this piece about what a crazy childhood she'd had. She had 62 scars, and people wrote into the LA Times saying that I should be like arrested by Child Protective Services. And I was like, wow, she's just that kid that would hang from the tree and fall down and break something. Like, that was her deal.
Yeah.
And we've always been able to like look at the body and like, oh, I remember when you got that one, or oh, I remember when you got that one.
Yeah.
But I have to confess to you that something I haven't, again, said to anyone. I just wrote an essay about a little bit of a guilt that I felt. When she was in kindergarten, I used to always go volunteer in her class. And there was a kid in there named Dion. And they were five, and he would come sit on my lap because he was just really damaged. And we went out to the playground one day, and he was lifting up his shirt. And I saw that he was trying to get air. And he'd been scarred all over his lower stomach. He'd been burned.
Yeah.
And when I took him to the nurse, I took him to the teacher, then I took him to the nurse, and we undid his pants, and someone had burned him with a cigarette below his stomach. And they looked like pink rosettes. That's what the burns looked like. And I felt so bad. I mean, we called CPS. I had met his grandfather. I later met his mother. And she sort of gently looked at me, because I used to bring him clothes and shoes, and he was a classmate of my kids. She played with him. And she looked at me, and she said, well, how many kids do you have? And I had three. And she said, well, I have seven, and I can't keep track of them all. And she said it in this very gentle, kind of vanquished tone. And Dion was just so, he was so little to have already had a strange person do that to him. And then he disappeared. And I felt really guilty that all I had been able to offer him was a month of bringing him clothes and having him sit on my lap now and then. And I wrote Victor from him. That's where I got the character, the idea that Victor had been scarred by some stupid guy who was really toying with him. That's exactly where that came from. Because I felt guilty that I have a lot of kids at my house. My nephew lives with me right now, who's 20. Unlike Fantine, I said yes when he said, can I come live with you? I have all these kids. My house is always full of 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
But I still feel guilty that if I can't help that one. And I know that that's where Victor came from, the idea of that scarring that he had on his back. And then when he's shot, there's the other big scar that he's going to have. And one of my nephews has been shot through the hand. I have 60 nieces and nephews. One of them has a bullet stuck in his shoulder that can't come out. And so when my nephew got shot in the hand, all I could imagine was him having held his hand up and the bullet going through it, because that's what happened. Just that whole gesture, you know, like, don't shoot. When you hold your hand up, it's such an instinct. All of those kind of scars, and the scars on the older men, were what was in my mind, right?
Yeah. It's interesting that scars, whether you depict them in fiction or just nonfiction, really represent the class divide, really represent the difference between someone who's going to say, we should call CPS on your ass.
Absolutely.
Versus, well, this is how a certain economic sector lives. I mean, and they don't have the sort of authority to come in and replace all the playground ships or all of the to make everything, quote, safe and all that kind of thing. I mean, it just occurs to me that really is interesting that would be one of the key things we don't talk about in terms of class divide. If we're going to look for physical remnants of what separates people, maybe this is it.
Well, the other big scar was the brand.
Yeah.
And that was a big part of A Million Nightingales, was that Moinette was branded on her shoulder with the fleur-de-lis, which is a beautiful symbol of New Orleans, but which is an actual brand that was used by people. And when I first went down to Louisiana, I went there with a neighbor who was from the area, and she and I went down there, and she was a geologist, and she drove a truck. And we were driving all around the sugarcane fields and meeting people. And we went to this plantation that was part of, you know, A Million Nightingales and part of this new book. And we were going to go on a tour. And this elderly black woman, she was about 62 or so, she was going to be the tour leader. And she and I looked at each other, and she said, where are you from? And I told her where I was from, Riverside, California. And she said, oh my gosh, you know, do you know so-and-so? And she listed, and I knew them. My the family I married into was married into that family. Yeah. So they're all like our cousins. And so she said, oh my goodness, you have to say hi to so-and-so and so-and-so because they all left. This was a tiny, tiny town in Louisiana near the River Road, the famous plantations. Well, she was giving the tour and she talked about a man named Pa Tase who had V's branded into his cheeks. That's because he ran away. And the widow who owned him had her initials branded into his face. The front of his face said V. And that was her relative, which means that was a distant relative of the people that I am married into a family to. And that means something huge even now to think about it. And so I've talked about that with my girls. We've talked about sort of the way that a brand works. And just again, think about that kind of scarring and then think about what we have now is the idea that we could be perfect.
Yeah.
Children can be perfect. And that is a huge divide. But I think we have to remember. You got to remember that there was someone who had a brand as chattel. And that could have been your great-great-great-grandmother. Well, I used to deliver books to a shut-in when I was in college. And she had a tattoo from the camps. Her name was Ruth Katzman. And she had a tattoo on her wrist. And she was disabled because she'd been injured in a Nazi camp. And I delivered books to her for an entire year, and she told me her life story. Well, that was the equivalent to a brand. So to me, it all means the same thing. There's the brand that was given to this poor kid, Dion, by some idiot guy. There's that brand. So yeah, I think that's really interesting, the idea of scars and what you carry with you.
Before we got the mics rolling, we were talking quite a bit about working class fiction and how there's plenty of it, and yet it still continues to be, I suppose, not really acknowledged by the literary establishment. If it is, I mean, you're one of the people who, you got this book. This book did get reviewed in the New York Times Book Review.
I was very lucky.
Yes.
I think of myself every time as lucky.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, I mean, what does it really take to get a sort of literary audience to reckon with these very significant aspects of poverty, of race, of being branded, of having, I mean, and of the body, really, which I think is the one thing I really came away with this book, was just how the body is warped or mutated by the activities that go around. I mean, what does it take? Does it take authenticity? Do you think the literary community requires some kind of authenticity that adheres to their respective tastes? I mean,
you know what's really, okay, think about it this way.
Yeah.
We love fiction.
Yeah.
People like you and me. I read all the time. This is my great joy in life. I don't watch TV, mostly because I couldn't get cable all these years because the drug dealer next door has a big tree and he won't cut it down.
Yeah.
So none of us can get cable that live near him. So we don't have cable. And then when they changed over, nobody in my neighborhood has TV.
Yeah.
We can't afford it. It's just so weird to live at that spectrum, and people are like, why do you still live there? Well, that's where I live. Like, it's where I've always lived. So the fact is that it sucks for us, but it means that my kids watch stuff on their laptops.
Yeah.
I read, and they read too. And what's fascinating to me is, think back to A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Best book ever, right? That was one of the books that made me a writer was that book. Do you remember in that book where there is a girl who's had a baby out of wedlock and someone throws a rock at the baby and the rock hits the baby's cheek and a drop of blood falls on the snowy white coverlet? Okay, I remember that so vividly because that's why I became a writer, because when I was 3, my mom taught me to read because a drunk babysitter used to drop me on my head and torture me, apparently. And my mother thought that if I could sit in the corner quietly reading, that no one would hurt me. She continued to take me to the babysitter because my dad had left, and that was the way life was. But what a great thing it was that she apparently taught me to read in one night. My mom's really scary. She's from Switzerland. You don't mess around with my mother. So think about it. I look at the way that my life played out. It was because I read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn that I thought a girl like me, who grew up in the orange groves with people who were hunting rabbits, you know, to eat, could write about that.
Yeah.
When I got to college, I had already, in the public library, at 14 and 15, read James Baldwin and Langston Hughes and Toni Morrison. Sula. Sula was the transformative book. Go Tell It on the Mountain, transformative book. Ceremony by Leslie Marmon Sokol. I found all these books in the public library. Those were the most democratic of institutions, were The Horrible Babysitter.
Yeah.
Public school, which allowed me, I had a great teacher who allowed me to sit in the corner and read, and the public library. When I got to college, you're absolutely right. Suddenly we were not reading books about working class people.
Yeah.
But I had two amazing classes, just the two, where we read Bread Givers by Anza Jezierska, and we read this book called Weeds by Edith Kelly. You see, I still remember them so vividly. Ceremony by Leslie Marmon Silko, I had already read.
Yeah.
And these were books that featured characters like the people I'd grown up with. And that's when I decided that maybe I could write fiction.
Yeah.
And I started out by writing about a young black guy who couldn't get a job. And that's because in where I'm from, Riverside, we go through the recession like 2 years before the rest of you guys do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've already had unemployment at 16% for 2 years.
Yeah.
We're the foreclosure capital of the country. You know, we do that well. We're the canary in the mine. So I wrote about this young black guy walking around looking for a job because I was already getting married very young. And my husband was black, and he was looking for a job. And he applied for a job as a security guard, and the guy told him straight up, white men only. And we were just, I mean, this was 1981.
Yeah.
Okay? I was 21 years old.
Yeah.
What else was I going to write about? And his brother was a firefighter, and I wrote about being a black, about a guy being a black firefighter. Everyone in my family, the entire day is about, did you work? Did you make enough money? Are we going to survive? So to go to college and find out that that wasn't valued was really weird. So here's what I think. I think the great books survive among people like us. Stuart Onan, Last Night at the Lobster, one of my favorite books of the last 2 years. I teach that all the time. Ernest J. Gaines of Love and Dust. Helena Maria Viramontes, Under the Feet of Jesus, which is about migrant workers in Central California. Those are the books that I love to read. I also read The Great Gatsby. Okay? I also just read an amazing novel by Susan Casey. Not a novel, a nonfiction book, The Wave.
Yeah.
I love that book. Have you read it?
I haven't read the novel.
Oh, the way she describes waves in physical terms, she's a great writer because she's writing a wonderful narrative about these monster waves, but she's showing you about the ships and the reefs and the way everything works and their effect on humans. I love that. And in a sense, to me, that's a book about work.
Yeah.
There are men who are working to measure the waves. There are men who are fishing on the waves. There are men who are trying to conquer the waves.
Yeah.
I love that.
Is it, though, limiting to some degree to just go ahead and look to work as the chief reason for fiction? I mean, maybe it's really about human consequence.
It's always about character. So I guess what I'm saying is, you're right. I wish that books like that got more attention. But the best way for me to sort of live my life is to teach a large class at the undergraduate level and teach those kids that book.
Yeah.
And every year, because my novel from 2001, High Wire Moon, was about, you know, migrant workers working in the orange grove. My brother lived in the orange groves. He lived in a barn. He grew grapefruit and oranges. He grew those Oro Blanco grapefruit that are like the size of, you know, softballs, and sold them to Japan for $35 each. So my brother was out there picking his fruit, and they're all guys from Oaxaca were in the next grove. And every Thursday, they'd be picking all day, and on Friday they'd show up and La Migra would come.
Yeah.
Because the grower would call La Migra, so he didn't have to pay him on Friday. Yeah. On Monday he would hire a new crew, on Friday he'd call La Migra. And my brother told me those stories.
Yeah.
It's all about work, it's just about survival.
Yeah.
The best thing I can do to honor that is to teach a large group of undergraduates these kind of books. And they will come up to me afterwards and say, no one ever gives me a novel about someone like my dad who works in the orange groves.
Yeah.
And they'll be crying. And I'll say that, you know, I guess that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Maybe that's really the way to get kids reading. I think maybe what we're talking about in terms of, you know, you see things like the Twilight books take off. You see things like Harry Potter, a previous iteration of readers, that takes off. The books that now take off are the ones that are supremely fantastical.
Mm.
I'm wondering if that's because
life is so scary.
Well, there's that, but I'm also wondering if it's because there aren't enough novels that speak to these many perspectives.
I think that some of the old classics, like, you know, Mean Streets,
yeah,
Perry Thomas, Man Child on the Promised Land, they came of age in a certain time, those books. Then you have Luis Rodriguez, but these are all nonfiction books,
yeah,
right? When it comes to novels, you're right. There are fewer people, it seems, willing to delve into that, but those novels are out there.
Yeah.
Like I said, I always manage to find them,
yes,
and I find them fascinating. But getting them into the hands of kids, speaking of, so I'm doing this new partnership with USC. Another writer, Jervy Tervelon, and I, and another writer, Gary Phillips, you know, we're writing about black Los Angeles, in a way, and Southern California. We are partnering up to get books to LA Unified School District kids by doing a magazine a kind of an online journal with original short fiction, but the whole story. Because a lot of times kids are just getting passages. I'm also going to classrooms. I can get my books at half price because I'm the author, right?
Yeah.
I will sell the book for $3 to a student because you know what they tell me? This is the first book I've ever owned in my life. They will hold this novel and say, is this mine to keep? And I say, this is yours.
Yeah.
And they're like, I've never owned a book in my life. Well, you know, I never owned a book like that. I never met a writer. But my mom was, you know, she took me to the library. But I didn't own those books. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I have all my children's books from my past. But the first book I ever bought was a paperback copy of Sula, 75 cents. It was being sold at the Riverside Public Library. Yeah. I treasure that book. I want the kids to be able to have a book, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the best thing I can do is give them my book, give them Stuart Onan's book,
yeah.
Give them Helena Maria Viramonte's
yeah.
book. Right.
No, I mean, I do some events with a bookstore in Brooklyn, and every time I'm in there, for an hour, and like someone's looking around, and I somehow turn into a bookseller. It's like, oh, you've got to read this.
You've got to read this.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I just did that.
I love that, too.
Some kid, like, you know, we got Paolo Bacigalupi's The Wind-Up Girl in his hand.
Right.
And thing that's great about that book is that it's both fantastical, but it really shows what this world could transform into because
right.
of the world building, because of the details, and it does deal with
it's
you know globalization, that kind of stuff.
Every time for
yeah.
me, it's about character and landscape and detail.
Yeah,
that's what propels me through any novel. And
yeah.
I love reading The Great Gatsby. I read that over and over.
Yeah.
There are some books that Tender is the Night. I love that one too.
Yes.
You know, but I think what's sad for me is okay, they're going to do the film remake, a film of The Great
yeah.
Gatsby, right?
Yeah.
And they'll do a film on Lincoln's biography and all that. But I want a film based on a book about characters like mine.
Yeah.
I do, and I want a film based on Last Night at the Lobster. That's a great book.
Yeah.
I want a film sometimes that's not in that purview. And not that it has to be about working class or anything,
yeah.
but I would like a little bit of a tough film that has characters of color. And, you know, my girls and I talk about this all the time. Where are the movies for them?
Yeah.
You know, where's TV for them? I mean, we grew up watching, you know, Good Times and The Cosby Show.
Yeah.
What's happening? Well, What's Happening, right?
That was a great show.
That was a great show. But we had Sanford and Son. We had all these
yeah.
great shows. These guys were like, we have The Game. The Game is a great show, by the
yeah.
way. We love The Game. But where are the movies for them? And Spike Lee was a huge influence upon, you know, people of my generation.
Yeah.
I remember watching my first Spike Lee film in college. And it was a big deal. Like, the whole audience was black, except for me. And
yeah.
we're sitting there, and we're like, this is amazing. I mean, look at this film. I miss having 10 movies a year like that. And I want it back.
That happened with me when Malcolm X, that came out. And
yeah.
Me and my mother and my sister were there in the audience, and we were the only white people there. But the thing is you know, I wanted to see it, and my mother was like, oh, my God. I've been reading reports of, like, shootings going on at the theater, and I'm like saying, shootings? Come on. You know, it's like this.
Not for Malcolm X.
The idea that there's going to be some hysterical speculation to prevent all types of audiences from seeing these kinds of movies. It's just always been something that's really
we love that
amused me and troubled
yeah.
me. You know?
We love that in my neighborhood where people go, oh, well, we can't show so-and-so at the
yeah.
theater because there'll be a gang shooting.
Yes.
And we're like, really? So the only movie we get to see is Die Hard 12 again? That doesn't seem very fair.
I know. I wanted to go back to your book, and I also wanted to talk about that New York Times book review. In her review, Francesca Mary wrote that having a writer as a narrator can sometimes be a disadvantage. The liberty to think in literary ways means the narrator's thoughts will be judged according to literary standards. But one thing she didn't mention in making that statement, and I think this negates her criticism somewhat, is the fact that you have tons of similes in this book from Fantine. I mean, just to give you one, the rising sun like a hot dime on a white sidewalk. I'm wondering, to what degree did you imbue this novel with similes to prevent any judgment of Fantine's perspective based off of literary standards? It kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the last question, but it is interesting in light of, like, getting, I suppose, the elite to understand where you're coming from, that it has to have some literary standards, some sort of, you know, brand to be scarred with, so to speak.
I never think about any of that
yeah.
when I'm writing. I mean, I have a full-time job and four big old kids at the house. They're all
mm-hmm.
taller than me.
Yeah.
I ride in my car.
Yeah.
I ride in my van. And then I write by hand. I still have the little notebook right here that I wrote all these pages for Take One Candle.
Yeah.
I have that little notebook. I never think about anything like that.
Yeah.
I then at nighttime, when finally everything's quiet and my neighbors have stopped coming over to borrow whatever, and it's literally, it's like 10:30, 11 o'clock before I get to write.
Yeah.
Then I'm transcribing what I wrote in the notebook on into the computer.
Yeah.
And it's like being high for me. I mean, I don't even drink coffee.
Yeah.
Half of my friends are dead.
Yeah.
From high school, from getting high.
Yeah.
I mean, my brother's dead.
Yeah.
From getting high. So I don't smoke. I don't even drink coffee. I drink my tea. But writing for me is like being high.
Yeah.
And I don't think about any of that. In fact, when I go on the second draft, when I look at the draft that I've written, then I have too many similes and metaphors because they bring me so much joy to write.
Yeah.
So I don't think about what the critic that you mentioned is going to say, because I just want to tell the story. But Fantine is the first narrator I've had ever who's been educated or intellectual in that way as a travel writer. She's like my fantasy character. I mean, I live 3 blocks from where I was born. I got a house full of kids. Fantine doesn't even have any food in her refrigerator, right? That's a big fantasy for me. That's just not how it works. Every morning I wake up and make 7 eggs.
Yeah.
I have chickens in the backyard. Every morning I make 7 scrambled eggs and 10 pieces of sausage. That's how many people live at the house. So Fantine was like my fantasy character. But I wanted to have Fantine be the kind of person who could look at a historical context and still be from where I'm from. So she is like me. In many ways, she is the closest to me like that. But my first book was full of people who couldn't read and write. And that makes it interesting and completely different for how they're going to view the world. But that doesn't mean they don't view the world with simile and metaphor. In fact, that's exactly how they view the world.
Yeah.
And my father-in-law, who passed away a year and a half ago, we had hours and hours long conversations about history and art and Booker T. Washington versus, you know, Frederick Douglass and versus W.E.B. Du Bois. And he was from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he didn't get to graduate from high school because he was so poor. And my father-in-law was one of the most educated, self-read men I've ever met. He spoke in nothing but metaphor and simile. And that's what I mean I find astonishing, is that people, again, don't realize language belongs to everybody.
Yeah.
It does not matter how, whether you went to college or not. So with Fantine, that was the first time.
Yeah.
So I felt a little bit more free, actually, to have her describe things, because she's a writer. First, I mean, my last character was a slave, a 14-year-old slave, right? And she saw the world on the way. And the character before that was a woman from Oaxaca who didn't speak Spanish, much less English. She spoke Mixtec. So the way she looked at the world was through a Mixtec Indian lens. I think for me, Fantine, she was an interesting departure because she was a writer. And writers are the most boring people in the world.
Yes.
Sit around doing nothing.
That's why you had to get her in a car.
In fact, that's what's really funny is my oldest daughter, she read the first chapter and she's like, I don't like this woman. She's a jerk. She said, she said, what's wrong with Fantine? She's an idiot. Why doesn't she just help her nephew? And I said, well, I don't know, because she is kind of a jerk. And Gail's like, I wouldn't even talk to her. She's a jerk. But you're right. The thing about when Fantine gets in the car with her father, her father sees the world in a very particular way too. So, yeah, I didn't fully understand everything that went on in that review. But the way Fantine describes her world is truly the way that I see the world around me, and we're not that different.
Yeah.
Except for that, again, she doesn't have any kids, and she's not married, and she has a lot of free time.
Yeah.
So I guess we're very different.
I wanted to ask you, why do you think food is really the best way? Because there's a lot of food in this. Like,
oh, yeah.
Lots of the rice making. You've got the gumbo.
You know, there's a little note for Jonathan Gold in my last 3 books.
Oh.
I love Jonathan Gold. I've only hung out with him like 3 times.
Oh.
But I really love Jonathan Gold, the way he writes about food.
Yeah.
Just the joy in which he describes food and the way he'll try anything. So I have a little thing for him in each of my last 3 books.
Yeah.
So there's this writer in the book, Jimmy Taco.
Yeah.
He like wants to be Jonathan Gold,
yes,
but he's not quite good enough. That was my joke. It's like to have the food writer who sort of pretends to try really great food, but the best food is what you eat in somebody's backyard. I mean, everybody knows that. That's what I was trying to say, is that the best food is what you are going to go home and eat in somebody's backyard.
Well, there's also the desperate call that Fantine makes on the road. Hey, help me out here.
Right.
I'm getting sick of this road diet of fast food. Yeah.
Right. And then what's interesting to me is everyone always jokes around with us about barbecue. Like whenever we go to, because we're a black family, they'll say, oh, you have to try so-and-so's barbecue if you go to Memphis, right?
Yeah.
And my girls and I always just give each other this secret look, and we don't say anything. We can't eat anybody else's barbecue, ever.
Wow.
Because you have Cousin Eddie and Joe Killer. That's who barbecues. And I mean, we have like 10 family things a year, and they barbecue like 200 pounds of meat.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of barbecue we're used to eating, is the kind that it's 120 and we're in the park and we're barbecuing.
Yeah.
Like, we're crazy. We're crazy. But that comes from our family. So it's the people from Oklahoma and Mississippi and Louisiana. Is you make a certain kind of hot link. We can't eat anybody else's barbecue. So we always crack up and we're like, oh, that sounds really good. And then we never go eat it, because no matter what, it won't taste like home. And I always laugh because we have the best fish tacos in Southern California. Because you know the right person to go to their house, they're like, oh, my mom's going to make you some fish tacos, right? Well, she'll be from Ensenada, where they originated fish tacos.
Yeah.
So I guess I was trying to do that, and I'm glad you picked up on it, because the best food is what you get at somebody in somebody's kitchen.
Well, it's also when you read a book, you're talking about that shock of recognition. It's, for me, it's often with food. It's like all of a sudden,
too.
Like, oh, well, hey, I've made that at some point, or I've been to a place where someone has made that, or something like that. It's just like, and it's one of those things that unfortunately, again, they've appropriated from us. It has to be Gourmet Magazine. I want the reverse of that. You know what I mean?
The Gourmet Magazine is fine, and I love looking at it. I love to cook. I cook all the time, but my kids' favorite recipes are the ones that I made up and the ones that are not written down. And I cook in a cast iron pot given to me by Grandma Alberta. And that's, you know, there are things that I have made in that cast iron pot that came from her and that I made up. And that's what my girls like to eat. When people come over, they're like, will you make that one rice? And I describe that rice in the book a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a Creole kind of saffron rice with sausage and beans.
Yeah.
Well, as the only white person in our huge family, we'll have 400 people. For one of these family gatherings.
Yeah.
That's the normal size group. It'll be 200 to 300, 400 people.
Yeah.
And I've been in that family. I just turned 50 since I was 16.
Yeah.
That's a long time. So my dish is this Creole saffron rice with black-eyed peas and hot sausage and garlic and other stuff. If I don't bring that, I'm in trouble. And we bring caramel iced cupcakes. That's my girls and I. That's what we bring. So they're always like, where's your rice? You better put your rice here. So it's kind of like that. That's what I was trying to say, too, is that you can't replicate that. I think you're lucky when you get to taste it.
Yeah.
And I love going to somebody's house and their mom will make something, like I said, like fish tacos or mole. I had the best mole the other day, and that's made by somebody in their kitchen.
Yeah.
That's the best.
Did you read Kurlansky's book on the WPA? It had all these really interesting recipes.
Yes.
Yeah, even one for braised gopher.
There's and you know, you remember the pie that's come back into vogue now is what's it called? Is it called chess pie?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like a pie of the depression. You know what I mean? Shoe fly pie, chess pie.
Yeah.
Those are pies of the depression.
Yeah.
Yeah, on my real father's side, he grew up on a sheep ranch during the depression in horrible circumstances. They ate bear. I mean, which is disgusting apparently. And they ate mutton. And so my father will never eat like mutton or bear or anything like that, but pie. Pie was a big deal to them. And my grandma apparently was the best pie crust maker. And again, that's just something like she taught me how to make a pie crust.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that.
One last question, and this is something I've been kind of curious to get your thoughts on. There was a buzzword that various pundits would toss around shortly after Obama got elected, and that was post-racial. and when I was reading this, it was very interesting because here we are in 2005 in this book. And I was thinking, I wonder if she's going to get up to Obama. No, she doesn't.
He's mentioned in there.
That's right. He is mentioned briefly.
Because I had to put it in there. Because when President Obama gave the speech at the Democratic National Convention, my girlfriends are like, did you see that brother up there giving that speech?
Yeah.
He is fine. But he has a really gorgeous wife. That's too bad. That's literally what my girlfriend said, is he was amazing. He was so handsome. Oh, that was 2005.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if there's a certain advantage towards, I suppose, sitting out the 2008 to 2010 racial political dynamic. Because, I mean, yeah, what we had with the midterms was truly terrifying. But also what we've had in terms of, oh, well, we don't have to talk about race anymore because now we have a black president, which is basically what post-racial meant. Does fiction have any answers for this dilemma? Are you possibly going to confront this question with a future novel?
Or? I'm trying so hard. I mean, look across the table.
Yeah.
And you see my younger two children.
Oh, yeah.
My nephew who lives with me, he looks like Bob Marley was reincarnated.
Yeah.
And people stop and take his picture on the street. He's a skateboarder, my nephew is. He's 20. His favorite singer in the world, Janis Joplin.
Yeah.
All right. He lives a skateboard life. His skater friends are of all colors. Yet he gets pulled over by the cops all the time. You can't imagine. He never makes it home without somebody threatening him. You know, he'll get threatened with a gun by a Chicano guy who thinks he's in a gang. He'll get pulled over by the police who think he's been in jail twice for people who thought he committed a burglary, and the people say, no, I've never seen this person before in my life. He's 20, and he has spent time already in jail for 10 days for something he didn't do two times. And what I'm saying is, how can we think that we're post-racial when that is that I stay awake every night. When my nephew moved in 8 months ago, my girls told him, you have to come home by 2:00. Because otherwise mom will stay up all night and she'll have a heart attack. And I'm quite fond of saying, and then when I die, your uncle has to raise you, and you know you don't want that. And he gets really scared, so he always comes home on time.
Yeah.
But how can I think that we're in a post-racial society when people judge my girls constantly by the way they look?
Yeah.
They're scholarship 3.5 college students, and yet if they're the only black person in class, someone always has something to say about that. And I'll never forget when Delphine, the middle one, was in an AP history class, an all-white class, and they bring up Huck Finn, and everyone's so excited to say the N-word over and over again. And they're like, it's okay to say it in here, isn't it, Delphine, because we're talking about the book. And she comes home and she's just like, really? That's what they were so gleefully able to say that word. And in a very strange kind of way. And she said, then they held up cotton. And they're like, oh, everyone looked at me like I'm supposed to tell them the history of cotton. And I said, my people didn't grow cotton. They were from Tulsa. They had oil. So that just, if a young black woman is still always going to be measured on in terms like that, that's what I was trying to say, is that when Fantine says she's black, the whole room changes. And that's the opposite of post-racial. And when I look at the way we're moving toward right now, actually, my next book, the book I'm working on, is about, finally, it's time to write about raising this family, right? And these kids and my nephew. And think about that as a classical American family. My mother's from Switzerland. She grew up like Heidi in the Alps. My natural father grew up on a sheep ranch during the Depression. It made Brokeback Mountain look, you know, pleasant. My ex-husband's family comes directly from African slavery, Cherokee Indian Trail of Tears, Irish plantation owners. There's no more classically American family than that.
I had a Roman candle with me, just a Roman candle. You can wear your sandals and I'll pour you just one cup of tea. Then you can go and rest, you haven't seen my best, so just spend an evening with me. Just a lazy evening.